a good time last night at Carnegie Hall, and looks like some people had too good a time at Carnegie Hall. I'm delighted that you're here today. I want to thank the people who were on our earlier panels. I got a very good report from them, and congratulate the Hardys who got up to be with them. We have three commitments I want to announce at the outset of the session. First, I'd like to ask Dr. Jim Young Kim, Professor of Health and Human Rights at the Harvard School of Public Health, Dr. Paul Farmer, the Founding Director of Partners in Health and our partner in Rwanda, Cynthia Ryan, the principal of the Schooner Foundation, to come up. These three organizations are... Hi, Jim. I think I should make an advanced admission here. You know, the Partners in Health is working with us and was going to be working with their involvement to build a national primary health system in Rwanda. We're also working in Malawi together, and we are working in Haiti to support the expansion of the AIDS program. So I'm very excited, having seen the work that they do, and being familiar with Jim Young Kim's work, not only with Partners in Health, but in his other capacities, at what they are attempting to do here. Their commitment is to build a global health delivery community of practice, to allow health practitioners to share information and experiences on the Internet. The Global Health Delivery Initiative introduces the idea of a new academic discipline of healthcare delivery science, focusing on the implementation of quality healthcare in poor areas. I think the academically, politically correct term is low resource setting. The Global Health Delivery Initiative will launch communities of practice as a new web-based information platform to help healthcare practitioners in developing countries access and share information to build a comprehensive strategy first for Rwanda's national healthcare system. In 2003, the per capita expenditure on healthcare in Rwanda was $7. Healthcare expenditures totaled just 3% of gross domestic product, which will tell you that the gross domestic product per capita was less than a dollar a day. We are working hard there to both lift the per capita income and to improve the healthcare system. But the prospect that we might actually teach people more about how to build systems of healthcare in low resource areas is very important. That I think is the genius of what Partners in Health has done in Haiti. People have come from all over the world to study it. They agreed to come. Paul has even moved his family to Rwanda. The idea that we can actually use technology to teach people all over the world to do this, to actually deliver healthcare, is without anywhere approaching adequate personnel by traditional standards, is enormously significant. And I want to emphasize something, too. The value of this is estimated at $500,000, I think. Sometimes we get carried away by the big dollar gifts. While this is a substantial amount of money, in terms of lives saved, potentially, it could be worth billions eventually, even though we're only talking about a cash valuation of $500,000. To me, that's the genius of this meeting. We have people who have good ideas, and we can hold them up to the light and see what an impact they can have just by the power of the idea and the quality of the people working there. I'm really excited about this. If any of you have ever been out in one of these remote areas where nobody's ever met a doctor, the idea that we could develop systems that would save lives is first the driving dream of the people that are standing up on this stage, but also one of the keys to whether the 21st century turns out all right. So please give them a big round of applause. Now I would like to ask Ann Cotton, the Executive Director of CAMFED International, to come up here. This is a project involving CAMFED, Skoll Foundation, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, Edelman, the Financial Times, the National Coalition of Girls' Schools and Ministries of Education in Africa. It is a commitment that is a multi-tiered one to exponentially increase educational opportunities in sub-Saharan Africa for girls and to strengthen accountability mechanisms. CAMFED is committed to provide at least 800,000 additional years of education to children in rural areas of seven sub-Saharan nations over the next 5 years to develop local capacity to increase accountability and educational delivery in 4,000 communities, to expand government partnerships to deliver best practices in girls' education in 10 countries. And it has been chosen by the Financial Times to be highlighted in its annual giving campaign. This commitment will impact the lives of 2 million children, young women. In sub-Saharan Africa, more than 218 million people live in extreme poverty. Fewer than two-thirds of all the children in the region will complete primary school, which means half of the world's out-of-school children live in sub-Saharan Africa. And if we can get them through primary school and into secondary school, each additional year of education will add 15 to 25% to their income for life. If you will remember when we had the opening session, I hate to sound like a broken record, but because of your remarkable commitment, and I think it's worth emphasizing, everything you hear people say about climate change, everything you hear about people say about resource depletion issues in the world is going to be dramatically aggravated if the projected population increases in the world occur. If we go in just 4 to 3 years from 6.5 billion to 9 billion people, there is nothing that will really stop it effectively except putting all the girls in the world in school and getting the young women jobs and access to the job market and the opportunity to build a stable life. They will delay marriage and have fewer children. And look, I'm all for the family planning services. I don't want to minimize that. I applaud the courageous people who work in it. But life is a matter of how you respond to the circumstances just around you. We are all that way. So, again, this is a commitment where all these people have committed about $15 million, which on a per capita basis is not very much, to increase education delivery in 4,000 communities in seven countries and affect the lives of 2 million children. So, Ann Cotton, I thank you and your partners, and we wish you well. On the third commitment, this is one of particular importance because this proves, I think, the value of the process in which we are all involved. So I would like to ask Sameer Shahada, the Assistant Managing Director of the National Insurance Company, John Podesta, President and CEO of the Center for American Progress, Myra Rudmans, Senior Fellow of the Center for American Progress and Middle East Progress, Marianne Cassati, a partner in Circle Financial Trio Foundation, Ival Gilady of the Portland Trust in Israel, Lois Herzeka, partner of Fried Frank, Nicholas Walsh, Executive Vice President of Foreign General Insurance of the American International Group, AIG, and Paolo Grassi, Senior Vice President and General Counsel of American International Underwriters, AIG, to come up. This commitment today is the product of 2 solid years of work growing out of the first global initiative. And given developments in the region, it could not be coming at a better time. AIG, Center for American Progress, the Middle East Investment Initiative, Circle Financial Group, Trio Foundation, Fried Frank, Harris, Shriver & Jacobson, DLA Piper, the National Insurance Company, and the Portland Trust are fulfilling a commitment to create an entity to provide political risk insurance to Palestinian small and medium-sized businesses. Those of you who are at the first, yeah, you give them a hand. Those of you who are at the first CGI may remember that we had a conversation about this issue because in 1993, when the big Israeli-Palestinian agreement was signed on the White House lawn, the very next day, it was in this month, 14 years ago, the very next day, I had 600 Arab American and Jewish American business people meeting together in the White House, and I asked them to commit to invest in the West Bank and Gaza, and they were all exuberantly enthusiastic, and almost nothing ever happened. And it was simply because, even though we were making progress toward peace, having the odd bomb go off every 6 months or so was more than enough to discourage investors into the territories, and not just the Jewish Americans, but the Arab Americans as well. So we decided that if the business people could get some form of insurance, we might have a better chance to get investors of all levels to support them. I have said this till I'm blue in the face. I know no poor Palestinians except those who live in the territories. And we have got to, now we have a real chance, in spite of the division between Hamas and Fatah, in spite of the division between Gaza and the West Bank, there is more interest in the Middle East in a reconciliation between the Israelis and Palestinians. The Israeli government, I think, has gained strength in recent weeks and months. The United States seems more interested in this. Again, we have another moment here of opportunity. I know I've been to this dance a lot of times over the last 14 years, but the nature of this challenge is that you just have to keep throwing yourself against the wall if it takes 100 years. There's no option but to follow some effort at reconciliation. So I cannot thank the people on this stage enough. This Palestinian political risk insurance project will help to remove, I think, significant obstacles to economic development. And we have potentially 10,000 small and medium-sized businesses in export-related industries that could benefit from the trade disruption and political violence coverage offered by political risk insurance. 90% of the registered Palestinian businesses are small or mid-sized, and that makes them especially vulnerable. If they just happen to be operating on the wrong street at the wrong time, they could be out of business for good. The unemployment rate in the territories today is about 25%. Only 10, and that includes almost no female participation in the workforce. About 10% of the women are employed. And the unemployment might reach as high as 47% next year. The poverty rate is about 2/3. Over the last 6 years, after the Intifada and then the conflict between the Hamas and the Fatah, the gross domestic product has declined by 25%. Declined by 25% or more. It would be a cruel irony if the internal degradation of their living circumstances contributed to making it more difficult instead of easier to make a political accommodation among themselves and with their neighbors in Israel. So these folks could not be doing what they're doing at a better time. We're out there now. Their commitment is worth this. All the work they've done is worth $1 million. The work that they will do once we get this thing funded and up and going will be priceless. I expect them to be in the MasterCard ad pretty soon, you know, where it says how much this costs. This costs $1 million. How much does this cost? It's priceless. So I thank you very much. I would now like to ask Vinod Sekar, the chairman of the Petrick Trust, to come up here. The Petrick Trust, this is a commitment from the Petrick Trust and the Sekar Foundation to create a biodiesel plant powered by Jatropha to create sustainable employment in the West Indies, a commitment worth $100 to $125 million. With partner governments, the Petra Trust will create a Jatropha-powered diesel plant. For those of you who do not know, Jatropha is a shrub that produces high-quality biodiesel, which is very easy for small farmers to grow in many climates around the world. I may have told you yesterday or the day before that the government of Malawi is co-investing with a private partner in the southern Africa on a plant that will involve them actually selling the biodiesel in especially designed containers back into Europe. The commitment creates employment and economic opportunity in a fledgling industry through the creation of new nurseries in small West Indian nations, plantations, and a biodiesel refinery. The project has enormous potential to be replicated in other areas of the world and encourages governments to work together for mutual benefit. I think this is worth saying. On today's cost, Jatropha is the second most efficient source of biodiesel. It can yield up to 2 tons of biodiesel fuel per year per hectare, translating to about 1,000 barrels of oil per year per square mile. And it is the conversion ratio, for example, is far more efficient than corn. I want to take just 1 minute to hype what Vinod is doing, because we have today we're at a sort of a standstill in the production of biodiesel and the replacement of oil for transportation with biodiesel for this reason. Any sort of biological product has to be broken down essentially into a sugar substance to be converted into fuel. That requires an enzyme process. The cheapest and best turnaround is with sugarcane, which is why Brazil has been so successful and why you heard the Prime Minister of Ethiopia say they wanted to do that. You can get a conversion ratio of about 8 gallons to about 1 gallon. However, most places cannot grow sugarcane in any substantial volume to do that. In theory, corn only gives you about 2.3 gallons per gallon. And since ethanol is 30% less efficient in general in traditional combustion engines than gasoline, conversion ratio is not so great. And as we now see all over the world, there are subsidiary consequences. You have taco riots in northern Mexico now because the price of American corn has gone from its traditional $2.20 to $2.40 price up to a high of $4. And we're having pasta riots in Italy because wheat has grown anywhere from its traditional price of about $4.60 up to $7.85 as people planted less wheat and more corn, and then we got a very bad break on the weather. So there are all kinds of pressures here. In theory, in America, you can take any kind of farm waste, so-called cellulosic ethanol, and make it ethanol and get 4-to-1 ratio. But the enzyme process is more than twice as expensive as it is to make oil. Tetrofa solves that. It is at present, at the present level of scientific development and the present level of economics in the conversion process, this is way the best alternative if you can't grow masses of sugarcane and deal with all the environmental challenges that presents. This presents no significant environmental challenges. So what he's doing for the West Indies is a great thing. And I predict that you will see an enormously increasing amount of interest in this in Africa, and I hope in other places where people want to get around without burning up the planet and aggravating the political instability that already exists because of excessive dependence on oil. So, Vinod, we thank you. We wish you well. And I hope we'll see Jatropha cars all over the West Indies, thanks to you. And thank you for what you're doing. Now, I thank all those people for their commitments. When we have the last session, I will have some amazing numbers for you on the smaller commitments and the aggregate impact of them, not only the commitments made here, but those made by those following us on the Internet. I just want to say one word about the next panel, because I think the subject is very important, and it's really the first time we had a chance to talk about it in a larger setting since the very opening. But I'm encouraged by the participation of, first of all, I thank Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, and a great force for peace and reconciliation in the world, President Mesic of Croatia, a nation with whom I worked very closely when we ended the ethnic cleansing in Bosnia. President Ramos Horta of Timor-Leste, a genuine hero for what he did for so long. And Prime Minister Erdogan, perhaps the most successful politician in the modern world here. We talked a little about this earlier, but, you know, with all the historic troubles in recent decades between the Kurds and the Turks, Prime Minister Erdogan's government was recently overwhelmingly reelected, and he actually has two Kurds in his cabinet in Turkey. And President Talabani of Iraq said, it reminded me that the Prime Minister's party ran better in the Kurdish area than the Kurdish National Party. So he also, as far as I can tell, is the only living politician anywhere in the world that gets along with both Israel and Iran. So he may be able to help us avert the worst consequences of the doomsday scenarios that have been sketched out for the region. So these are three people who have seen what it's like when people let their differences take them to the gates of hell. And they are three leaders who are working to bring them back. So I thank them for that. I thank Mary Robinson. And I especially want to thank our last committee member, Rupert Murdoch, because of the global media influence, I think it's worth talking about here what the role of the media is in increasing or decreasing the kinds of conflicts that seem to be driving so much of the world. And if your goal is just to cover the story that's unfolding, doesn't matter how you cover it, what are your responsibilities? Should you look at least for the opportunity to tell people that there are alternatives to the conflict scenarios which are playing out in so many parts of the world? And You may remember last year I cited this as evidence of my efforts at peacekeeping. We had Rupert Murdoch and Barbara Streisand standing together to support our climate change initiative. And Rupert has just re-upped his support for that. So I'm very grateful to him for his support of that. But today, I thank him and all of our panelists for coming together to discuss what still, when all is said and done, may be our most important task, how to manage our differences and find a way to live together and work together. Thank you for being here.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists, Chairman and CEO of News Corporation, Rupert Murdoch. President of the Republic of Croatia, His Excellency Stjepan Mesić. President of the Democratic Republic of Timor-Leste, His Excellency Jose Ramos Horta. Prime Minister of the Republic of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And our moderator, former President of Ireland and President of Realizing Rights, the Ethical Globalization Initiative, Mary Robinson.
Well, good morning, everyone. And following what President Clinton said, both about this panel and our subject, I think we're really going to have a very interesting discussion. As you know, two of our distinguished presidents, President Mesić and President Erdogan, are going to speak in their own language, and you will hear the simultaneous translation. So you need to have your gear ready, as I do too. And I was thinking what a privilege it is to chair a panel of two presidents in office, a prime minister in office, and an empire building his empire. But I think that we will break this wide subject of the impacts of global migration, the mass communications and yet divides in our world, cultural divides, ethnic divides. We'll break it into issues that we can address. And before I put my first questions, I would like to just add a little more to the introduction of the panelists. As you have heard, Prime Minister Erdogan and his party recently won elections in July again, and he and his party have been recommitting to European accession for Turkey, have been working on Turkey being a consensus builder to an extent, and I want to ask him about that. And interestingly, when I looked a bit deeper into his background, he has acknowledged roots in Georgia and mentioned this on a relatively recent visit to Georgia. So that sense of different identity composition I also find interesting for this panel. President Jose Ramos Horta, the President of the Democratic Republic of Timor-Leste, I have known for a long time as a good friend, and I saw you in different capacities from the time when you won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1996 together with Bishop Bello, through holding office once your country became independent, foreign minister, I think you were for a while even defence minister, and then most recently prime minister before being elected president. And again, I think you have a wider vision. Indeed, there's a rumour you might even stand someday for UN Secretary General. So we'll expect a wider vision from you. President Mesić has again led his country in an openness, having been re-elected in 2005 for a second term in as president. He's credited with opening the process of normalization in the region and giving Croatia the political and economic traction it needs to make a strong bid, as it is doing, for European Union and NATO membership. And in a sense, it's hardly necessary, I think, to introduce at any length Mr. Rupert Murdoch, the Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of News Corporation, most recently, I think, in the news pretty well worldwide for the acquisition of Dow Jones, including, obviously, the Wall Street Journal. So, as I said, we're going to be looking at some of the kind of issues and components of how you try to build a more multi-ethnic, more inclusive society, more inclusiveness within sub-regions, and ultimately a less divided world. And I'd like to start with the subject of language. I was very struck when I was in Nairobi in January attending the World Social Forum, which is a forum that brings together social movements, small NGOs from around the world, that four languages were available to the participants in the conference: English, Spanish, French, and Swahili. And so there was an attempt to understand that language matters, that diversity of culture matters. And I'll begin, if I may, with you, President Ramos-Horta. When your country became independent, it changed its name from the more familiar to many, East Timor, to Timor-Leste. And you yourself are somebody who has the different strands in your own background. Your mother was Timorese, your father was Portuguese. And there is a local language, Tetum, as I found when I visited East Timor-Leste. Also Portuguese is used, but might it be Indonesian? Might it even be English? I mean, what is the language situation, and what is the significance of the change to Timor-Leste, a Portuguese nomenclature? I can't even pronounce that. Please.
Well, we are a country very new, 5 years old, vast majority Catholic, 95%, but with other smaller religions like Protestant and Muslims. For 500 years it was a Portuguese colony, and with Christianity it shaped the identity and the boundaries of the country. After independence in 2002, we struggled to adopt the official languages, and we thought of combining the most important indigenous national language called Tetum, is a Malay language, and the Portuguese as the two official languages, together with two other working languages. One is Bahasa Indonesia, a very dynamic language that was introduced in Timor after 75, and English. In our constitution, we have these two working languages, Bahasa Indonesia and English. And the next 10, 20 years, as these other two languages progress, we'll be a multilingual country like Singapore, like Switzerland. The four languages coexisting very well, besides some local indigenous languages that probably, unfortunately, might dwindle in the years to come. You ask about why we switch from East Timor, which is most commonly known, to Timor-Leste. Well, I myself got confused why we changed it. And I'm never offended when people, instead of using Timor-Leste, which is the official name, they use East Timor. I don't make a fuss about it.
Thank you. I'm very glad you're not going to make a fuss. President's message, your country has come out of a very troubled period in a very troubled region. The official language is Croatian, but you have a need to communicate well with Serbs, with Montenegrins, with Bosnians. How do you see the language issue, and have you been able to take steps yourself to be more inclusive and try to foster that?
Undoubtedly, language is a matter of identity. You were right to say that Croatian is the official language in Croatia. However, children in elementary school learn are taught in their own languages, Hungarians, Czechs, Serbs. And I believe that this is a good thing. Perhaps it would be better to use the language in such a way that it should not be regarded as an opposition to other languages. During the Yugoslav period, there was an attempt to unify the languages, as there was the attempt to unify the nation, to create a Yugoslav nation. However, this process did not work, and it failed. The same went with the creation of the so-called Yugoslav language. This could not have positive outcome. Now that Croatia is an independent country, Croatia allows national minorities to use their own languages. However, it needs to be said that we do communicate easily among each other. Croatians speak the Croatian language, but they understand the Serbian language. Croats speak their own language, however, they do understand Bosnian and Montenegrins. So we are talking about the languages which do have their differences. However, there are attempts to stress in an inadequate way the differences between the languages, and I don't think this is necessary. I think that it is enough to acknowledge that we are talking about different languages, but I think it's very useful that we can communicate without any problem. There is a town in Croatia which was devastated in war. It was a victim of the Serbian aggression. And after the war, it is necessary to bring people closer, to make them homogeneous. We need to reconstruct the country to alleviate war consequences. And we are trying to do our best to encourage children from kindergarten age to start to befriend with other ethnicities. And I believe it would be good that children are taught in their own languages, but they should go to the same schools. Because if we separate children of different ethnicities in elementary school, they will never become friends. So I'm in favor of the homogeneity of the society, because our goals are common.
Thank you very much. I now turn to Mr. Rupert Murdoch. You looked at me as I introduced you as an empire builder, but let me just refer to what Business Week said, speaking about what it called Murdoch's empire. His satellites deliver TV programs in five continents, all but dominating Britain, Italy, and wide swathes of Asia and the Middle East. He publishes 175 newspapers, including the New York Post and the Times of London, and now, of course, the Wall Street Journal. In the United States, he owns the 20th Century Fox Studio, Fox Network, and 25 TV stations that reach more than 40% of the country. His cable channels include fast-growing Fox News and 19 regional sports channels. In all, as many as one in five American homes at any given time will be tuned in to a show, News Corp, either produced or delivered. So my language question is there a danger of a communicated, more political language, in your case, coming from a right perspective? And I say that as somebody who comes from a left perspective. Neither of us are central figures. And is there a danger with that power of communicating?
Right.
Yes, I know it's not, but I'm talking politically. Thank you, President. I'm talking about the language of being able to communicate and having quite a strong ideological base for that communication.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that we don't dominate with anything anywhere. In the old days, you could have put all this together and said that sounds very big. Today, in the digital age, that's all gone. Everybody has ultimate choice of what they watch, what they listen to, and make up their own minds. Do we, in our newspapers, and only in our newspapers, maybe enter into public debates and do things? Yes, most certainly. We think that's all part of the education of a advanced society. There should be debate about big issues. Our job really is to, in newspapers and the written word and on the web, is to educate people in all countries. Everything we go is available everywhere. But we're, you know, a tiny fraction of that when you consider what is there. Anybody today can start a website and put out their views, and if they're popular, if it's well done, they get a huge audience all over the world. There are many instances of this. You know, on the question of language, I would just say that, of course, we try to respect in everything we do the culture of every country to which their language is so valuable. So when we distribute films or television programs, they're always in the language in the country in which they're broadcast. And if we didn't, we wouldn't exist. Our competitors would drive us out of business. It's just a natural function of media today. It has to respect local cultures. But its big job, in my view, and its big duty, is to educate people, to show people all over the world how other people live, and to create understanding, and that is the way to overcome divisiveness.
Thank you. I think we'll come back to some of those issues. But I want to bring in Prime Minister Erdogan at this stage. As I mentioned in introducing you, you see your government and Turkey itself as playing a consensus-building type role in that region, and you've spoken about that. I want to start within Turkey itself. You have a large Kurdish minority, and there was a time, as I understand it, when the Kurdish language was actually forbidden, which is not strictly the case now. It is used to some extent. To what extent do you think it would be helpful that it would be more available in schools and as a way of helping an internal reconciliation and inclusiveness? Thank you.
Let me first of all start by correcting something, and that is the people of Kurdish origin in Turkey are not subject to minority law. They are part of a whole. They have never been considered a minority. So I want to specifically underline that first, because as you will know, Turkey is going through an accession process to the European Union, and minority law is different, and the country and the people living in the country are evaluated differently as such. In Turkey, the language, the official language, is Turkish. Our official language right now is Turkish, but Kurdish is available when people speak it amongst themselves, and are the people who live in Turkey who are of Kurdish descent can speak in Turkish. They also have opportunities to now open language courses so they can learn to speak and teach their language, and constitutional amendments have been made to this effect. This is in fact a step we have taken within the framework of adhering to the Copenhagen political criteria in the EU. So right now there is Kurdish broadcast on television. People can go to language courses in Kurdish, or you can have announcements on billboards or some entertainment programs. So this process has been initiated already. So there is no obstacle whatsoever in that respect. I wanted to specifically make this point. In Turkey, we are also a multi-ethnic society, and we are all citizens of the country, but we have many different ethnic origins, and we view this as a source of richness for us. And of course, one of the most important topics under different cultures is language, and language is a very important source of richness for us. Language is also important as an instrument, a tool, if you will, of having unity in a country. So it is a very important element in the communication of the individuals with their state, because if we don't have a language that everyone can understand, then it would be difficult to carry out this communication. So to this day, we have not had any issues or problems with having Turkish as our official language. Turkish is our official language, but as I said before, people are free to speak their own language when they speak to each other, or they can broadcast in their language, they can go to language courses. So we have the constitutional basis for that. Thank you very much.
As I said, I deliberately thought we'd take that piece, the language component, and I think we've heard from each of you on that. Let me just bring an Irish dimension, because, you know, Ireland also has changed dramatically in recent years. 10% of the population... Oh, sorry. Where is it?
I was just bringing an Irish dimension, because we like to... 10% of the modern Ireland is non-Irish-born, which is a very big change. And recently, when I was in my part of Ireland, which is the west of Ireland, County Mayo, I was pleasantly surprised to see the local paper had a page in Polish, because we now have many Polish and Latvian and others, and from North Africa, etc., and they are contributing to a modern Ireland. So I think we might get into that. I want to now broaden the issues to look more at reconciliation, and perhaps you can, each of you, as you respond to questions, look to your sub-region as well. And again, if I might start with you, President Ramos Horta, on the issue of internal conciliation. I visited your country several times as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights when it was in terrible grief and turmoil, and you had both the internal and you had the external, your big neighbour, Indonesia. How do you see the situation now? What are the steps you're taking?
We are in a unique situation, unlike many other post-conflict situations where the conflict was largely internal, with some external involvement, obviously. But in our case, it was a foreign intervention, annexation, occupation, that resulted in what some call genocide. Out of a population in 75 of only 700,000, by 1979-81, estimated 200,000 had died from the conflict. Now we are a population with tremendous demographic growth, the second highest in the world, of almost 7.5 children per family. When we became independent in 1999-2000, formal accession to independence in 2002, we decided from day one we cannot look back to the past, no matter the individual suffering of each. No family was untouched in my country. Myself lost brothers and sisters. We had, and the conflict, the death was not caused only by the Indonesian occupation. Timorese killed each other as well. So first we had to heal the wounds in the country, and also heal the wounds with Indonesia. And one of the, I think, great attributes to our people, our struggle for 24 years, is that although we are Catholic majority, Indonesia Muslim majority, we never manipulate religion to turn people against Indonesia, because Indonesia is Muslim, we are Catholic, so we are victims of the Muslims. We never did that. And because we also said the Indonesian people were also victims of the regime. How many hundreds of thousands of Indonesian Muslims were victims of the regime? Mm. So for us, it was not difficult to mobilize the people in reconciling with Indonesia. And Indonesia is one of the first countries to recognize our independence. President Megawati Soekarno Putri came to our Independence Day with President Bill Clinton 2002. Today we have the best relationship. Indonesia is actually the leading country helping us entering ASEAN. They even seconded some senior Indonesian diplomats to advise us. And so happened with the rest of the region. What is important is that, in my experience, is that when leaders do not engage in manipulation of sentiments, the common people follow you. The vast majority of people, they harbor no hatred, no resentment. So, although there's still wounds in my own country, internally, we don't have a people killing each other for sentiment of revenge. They kill each other because of land dispute, housing dispute, but not because of some revenge, well, you killed my father, or the Indonesians killed. So that's it's still a long process, but in that regard, I think we have been somewhat successful.
Thank you. I think it's remarkable in the particular circumstances that you mentioned, 95% Catholic in your country, beside the largest Muslim country with that background, but religion didn't become a divisive political aggravating a situation, but rather you managed to reconcile. I say that because, again, in an Irish context, religion was at least part of the problem for quite a while. In the Northern Ireland context, it tended, when it was manipulated, as you said. I'm going to turn now again to you, Prime Minister Erdogan. You have taken a more global initiative in the context of trying to promote understanding. You are co-chair with Spain of the Alliance of Civilizations. Tell us, perhaps briefly, because time is always the tyranny, how you see it now, this alliance, and your hopes for it.
Let me say that the Alliance of Civilizations, is a very important initiative, and it is very important for global peace, which was also expressed as being very important for the 21st century by the United States at the turn of the century. And we initiated this initiative of Alliance of Civilizations under the auspices of the then Secretary General, Mr. Annan, in co-sponsorship with the Prime Minister of Spain, my colleague, Mr. Zapatero. And our goal is to overcome this notion of a clash of civilizations and instead introduce the concept of an alliance of civilizations, because cultures and religions cannot clash. It could only be the actors, the members of a culture or a religion. They may misrepresent the culture or religion they belong to and hence create clashes, in our opinion. So it is not in essence a clash of the civilizations themselves. When you look at the terrorist organizations around the world, you will see that there are terrorists who belong to this or that religion or that this or that culture, but that does not mean that that religion or that culture provides support to terrorism, because every religion, every civilization, every culture is against such acts. So this is the essence of the struggle we must be engaged in, and this will happen only through an alliance, not a clash of civilizations. And to achieve that, all countries must cooperate, and all representatives of all civilizations must work. And there is a committee of wise men within the Alliance of Civilizations, made up of 20 members. That was the first step that the Alliance took, and that committee of wise men, a high-level group, worked for some time to come up with a declaration first, and that declaration was announced to the world in Istanbul. And immediately after that declaration, we started working on establishing secretariats for the Alliance of Civilizations. And the UN Secretary General, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, appointed former president of Portugal, Mr. Sampaio, as the director of the project, and this is a project that is picking up speed as we speak. And in this process, different cultures, different religions around the world, and they will be brought together. We have to prove that we can coexist peacefully. And political leaders have a very important role to play. For example, at the moment at the General Assembly, at the UN, about members from about 70 countries came together within the context of the Alliance of Civilizations. And if we succeed in our efforts, I think terrorism will not find fertile ground for its actions in the future, and we will be able to fight more effectively against ignorance and poverty, because the root causes of terrorism lie in poverty, in ignorance. And if we are able to remedy that situation and improve the situation, then this will contribute to world peace, because we will have a world where we will have more people who are better educated and who are better off. And the politicians have a very big role to play in this respect. If we, as the politicians, fail in this effort, history will question us. And one more thing. No matter which civilization or religion we are part of, we must understand something very well. Our differences are actually a source of richness for us. And as we all take our deserved place within the Alliance of Civilizations, we have to believe in the concept of unity in plurality. And that is what is going to create the bright futures that we all hope for. And we must also understand that none of us know everything. We may all make mistakes, and others may be saying the right thing. So the moment we understand that we are not the ones who are always in the right, I think we prepare a better ground for achieving greater unity. And so that is the core of the Alliance of Civilizations. This is what we are working for a brighter future. And with my colleague, Prime Minister Zapatero of Spain, we will continue to work very hard. And I hope that everyone who can contribute can contribute. Thank you.
Thank you, Prime Minister. And following directly from what you were saying about the Alliance of Civilizations, I'd like to ask Mr. Murdoch about the role of the media. The role of the media in, it has been accused of creating, of fostering a divisiveness. Let's just take, for example, how a lot of reporting on what we call the war on terrorism, the references to Muslim extremists that hurt so much in that region, and also a divisiveness on issues of migration, the use of very harsh language in the media to describe undocumented migrants in countries. How would you respond to this sense that the media can be part of the problem?
First of all, I'd just like to support, I thought, the beautiful words of the Prime Minister of Turkey, especially when he said that diversity can lead to so much richness in every society. And we have to, I think we have, the greatest example of that right here in New York. There could be no more diverse society than the 8 million people living in New York. They're migrants from all over the world, they're different religions, different races, and we all get on, and everybody who wants one can have a job and a good living here. The question of the media and how it reports things like the war on terror. The war on terror is a very real thing. Sometimes it's expressed in different ways. There are different people with different views on it. But there's no question, and how do we bring religion into it? I don't think so. I think that there are facts about the jihadists who are a very real problem. They may not be so huge in number, but they're certainly creating a very difficult world at the moment. And the response to it may not be right. We don't know.
Do you accept that using terminology like Muslim extremists is very hurtful and yet very common.
Well, it has been the case in the Middle East. I mean, there were Catholic extremists in Northern Ireland. There were Protestant extremists in Northern Ireland.
But we don't use that terminology.
And that's how they define themselves. I think the answer to all this, again, is what the Prime Minister said, is prosperity. The greatest enemy, the greatest chance to beat back these things is for everybody to have a full stomach, to put it at its crudest. And we've seen with the growth of free markets, disappointingly slow growth maybe in international free trade, but certainly with free markets, we've seen hundreds of millions of people coming out of terrible poverty in the last few years. In India alone, since they changed their economic policies in the early 90s, we've seen 400 million people come out of starvation and poverty. And the same is happening in China and other countries to lesser extents. So I think we should be very optimistic. I've spoken too long. I'm sorry.
Thank you. No, that's fine. Taking that point about the importance of coming out of poverty, of greater prosperity, I'd like to ask President a message about the way in which your country is changing and also your country within the region. I was interested to note that the GDP of Croatia, the average GDP per head is about $15,500, and it's therefore greater than countries like Poland, Romania and Bulgaria, which happen to be EU members. So from that point of view, you're making good progress. But there is still the concerns about that region. So how do you see a sort of way out for Southeast Europe?
Thank you very much. The GDP per capita is a bit smaller, lower, but this is not so important. There are beliefs that the war in our region was created due to the hatred between the nations which had been part of the former Yugoslavia. Given the fact that I was the last president of Yugoslavia, I can tell you, I can share my first-hand experience with you of what had happened. Yugoslavia survived due to the charisma of Marshal Tito. When he died, the Communist Party, which was multinational, collapsed, while the inert and expensive mechanism called the Yugoslav Army looked for a sponsor, and they found one. That was the head of Serbia, Slobodan Milosevic. I proposed a new model, a new political agreement, a model of confederation. Milosevic did not even want to think about it. He wanted a greater Serbia, which would be ethnically clean. And this is why he decided to wage war, where he planned to commit genocide and war crime. Why? Because the Yugoslav army sided with him. He wanted 63% of the territory of Bosnia and Herzegovina. He wanted to have one-third of the Croatian territory, and he wanted to exterminate or to cleanse all non-Serb population. And this led to a huge adverse consequences. The war is finished. The losses were great, especially the loss of the Muslims in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and a lot of hatred remained. But many people believe that the cause of war was the hatred, but no, hatred was actually the product, the result, the outcome of the war. Hatred happened due to what had happened during the war. So what is the way out of this? I will give you an example of a way out. The relations between France and Germany. For hundreds of years, Germans and the French waited for territory. But then they said to each other, why should we wage war? Let us open our borders. Let's cooperate. And today, France and Germany have the lead in democracy, but also in their mutual cooperation. And this is what we are offering in our region. We want to comply with the European standard. We want to become a member of the European Union. We want to fulfill the criteria that the EU sets for its members. In order to do that, in order to become members of that club, we need to respect the standards of that club. And once we open our borders between our respective countries, then the national minorities will never serve as an excuse for war. They will never serve as an excuse to take somebody else's territory, but they will represent a bridge between our countries. So I believe that if we didn't have national minorities, we would have to invent them in order to create this bridge of cooperation.
Thank you. I can fully understand the importance of that framework as you have described it, and I must say I have seen the impact of making progress towards membership. Turkey is also making specific changes, and your government is committed to a constitutional change in that context, so it is helpful. I'm going to come back to something very central to my thinking. I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about values in this context of promoting more understanding, more acceptance of multi-ethnic, multicultural diversity in our world, both within countries, in regions, and globally. I'm going to ask each of you the same question, so you have it in advance now. And the question is, we're coming up, starting on the 10th of December this year, to the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And it has been accepted by every country in the world. And the rights covered are both civil and political rights, and also economic, social, and cultural rights, like rights to food and safe water, health, education, etc. It was notable that President Bush, when he spoke to the UN General Assembly this year, quoted Article 1, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights, Article 25 on the right to health, Article 26 on the right to education, Article 23 on the right to work. He read them out. So this was a remarkable reminder. I'd like to ask each of you how important you think it is that we speak more about our shared values. I'll start with you, President Ramaphosa.
Well, when we acceded to independence in 2002, in keeping with my own personal commitment pledges during the struggle for independence, I used to say, on day one, we would ratify all existing international human rights instruments. May 20, 2002, I took to the Council of Ministers and then to Parliament ratification of all 7 core international human rights instruments. We, in our constitution, forbids death penalty, and we don't even have a life sentence, maximum 25 years. And that's because of our individual personal convictions in about the sanctity of human life, about the values of freedom and so on. So I just came from giving a small talk at the UN, right now was taking place, hosted by Italy and Portugal, calling on a moratorium on death penalty. And obviously we at Timor-Leste subscribe to that. For us, it is our commitment to the Human Rights Declaration, the various conventions, is born out of our personal experiences. And we didn't like being tortured. We didn't like not being free. And once we are free, well, we have to honor this and helping others. So for us, it's a very, very natural thing, like freedom of press. Mm. We have one of the best respectful freedom of press in our country. No control, people set up a newspaper like you open a restaurant, mm. No license, and partly because we are very disorganized, but we don't really pay attention to how many newspapers open, radio stations, and all of them.
Thank you. Prime Minister Erdogan, there is a tendency sometimes to see particularly international human rights as somehow Western values or ideas. And as we mark the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was brought together by jurists from China, from the Lebanon, from Chile, from France, etc., is there a sense in your country that the Universal Declaration it will be helpful to promote values in that region, and that it would be good to mark the anniversary very publicly?
Let
me say that on this point we cannot speak of regionalism. We have to think more in more universal terms, because the world is going in that direction. And for us, we are a country, of course, that ratified the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And my political party bases its progress and outlook into the future on four pillars. One is education, another is health, the other is justice, and the fourth is security. These are the order. These are the main principles of our political party. When we came to power, education ranked fifth in our national budget, whereas it ranks first in the last 4 years in our national budget. It takes the greatest share, in other words, from the budget, because education is very important. We have to pay a lot of attention to it. As it was said before, on the issue of freedoms, freedoms are important, but not just in a conceptual framework. We have to look at it in many different ways, like freedom of expression, thought, religion, conscience, assembly, freedom of enterprise. These are all very important, and we have to be able to experience them. And the moment we can fully experience them, free societies will really feel the satisfaction of living freely. In our context of Alliance of Civilizations, there are four topics which are of great importance to us. They include youth, education, migration, and they will be all important parts, as well as the media. The media is also part of our work in the Alliance of Civilizations, because we need the support of the media if we want to achieve a world without extremism. And the moment we can achieve that, we will have succeeded.
Thank you, Prime Minister. Indeed, it would be very good if there could be a particular focus during 2008 of the Alliance of Civilizations on the shared values of the Universal Declaration, because that will help the very fine purposes that you highlighted. Mr. Murdoch, what plans has News Corp for ensuring that all the media outlets that you have some influence on will highlight the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
I don't know what we're doing about the anniversary.
I
don't know what we're doing about the anniversary, but we constantly, of course, promote that and applaud when people stand up for human rights. I mean, one should not forget the part that the United States has done in the last century in saving Europe, first from fascism and then from communism. What are we all others doing? I mean, in our own countries, we've got to push it and drive it. But here we are sitting here today, and we haven't mentioned the horrors that are taking place in Myanmar. You only have to read this morning's newspapers and look at the photographs. The human rights are being just steamrolled. What should be done?
Well, certainly that's an issue that the Club of Madrid, which I participate in, has come out very strongly on. We were on the platform yesterday being honoured for our work in climate change, but afterwards we had a meeting and we felt it necessary to speak out on the situation in Myanmar and to call for a stop of the killing of civilians who are peacefully protesting, Buddhist monks and nuns, ordinary civilians with that courage. So it is important that the media draw attention to these issues. But I think we were focusing on...
I bet it's talk enough.
Yes, exactly. I think there needs to be maximum political pressure. It is a very important issue. We're a little bit short on time, as always. It's the tyranny. But I did want to bring President Masic in on this. In a way, President, if you could, we haven't, in this context of intercultural opening up, talked about the gender dimension. And I'd like to ask you about the values of the Universal Declaration in terms of women and women's participation and indeed the whole agenda of Beijing that has been a bit sidelined. For your region, what do you feel about that?
As far as Croatia is concerned, we are a multi-ethnic but also a multicultural, multi-confessional society. However, we share the same values because we share basically the same cultural background, both the Orthodox Christians, Catholics and Muslims belong to a society which could set an example of tolerance if there hadn't been for the war which left antagonisms between the groups. And this is why we are in favor of the individualization of guilt, which means that the perpetrators of crimes should be tried, because the nations, the groups, are not, do not have the guilt for this. And I believe that ICTY, the Hague Tribunal, is very important in this. It played an important role, but not always the adequate role. We had a trial where hundreds of prisoners were killed in one day, and they got sentences which horrified the whole world. So we expect that the second degree sentence will be more just, because our national courts will act in the same way. The International Hague Tribunal has to be just, and this should be reflected on the national courts. And when the guilt is individualized, then we will have the society which protects the same values, but also the rights of the vulnerable groups, including the ethnicities.
Thank you. We're really more or less coming to the end of our time. I wanted to maybe put in context for this excellent panel why I wanted to raise the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. If we reflect back to the world of 1947-48, it was a world that had seen two world wars, a terrible Holocaust, dropping of nuclear bombs in Japan, and the beginnings of a Cold War that was going to last for quite a while. And people were very fearful. And we had this vision and this declaration, which has been translated, as President Ramaswamy reminded us, into covenants and conventions. But the declaration itself is repeated over and over again. There's no country that doesn't accept it. And it seems to me that you've been reflecting in a way on this panel some of the issues in our world today. It's a world that is most like the world of 1947-48, because we still have the divides that need the Alliance of Civilizations. We still have a nuclear threat that will link to potentially a dirty bomb, which is extraordinarily worrying, but the nuclear proliferation issue is very much on the table. And we have climate change, which other panels have been speaking about. And it seems that our message from this panel might well be we need to build more on the common values that we have if we want to have a multi-ethnic, pluralist world where there is social inclusion, there is cultural inclusion, where people who are part of a country feel that they too are citizens in the sense that they have full expression of their identity. So I really would like to thank the panel. I think we still have three more minutes. So maybe I'll just get a last word. Oh, we're 3 minutes over. I'm sorry, yes. All right, we're 3 minutes over. May I thank you very much indeed for a wonderful discussion. Thank you. Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, the plenary session is now concluded. Working sessions will begin at 11:15 to allow ample time for discussion. The summation and closing session will start here at 2 p.m., 30 minutes later than scheduled in the printed program. Thank you very much.